Welcome to Country Fried Rock, where we talk with musicians to find out what inspires their creativity. Country Fried Rock, music uncovered. Patrick Sweeney, who I first heard at Americana in 2011, with an amazing showcase at The Basement. Welcome to Country Fried Rock.
Glad to be here.
This is a treat for me. I'm always seeking a band that just kind of blows my mind when I go to their showcase. And this year, that night at The Basement was amazing, and that your show was part of it.
Thanks. Yeah, The Basement, actually, Mike Grimes and, the folks at The Basement are like, they're like my Nashville family. I mean, they're the reason I live in Nashville. They were the only club that would book us as a touring band. And coming through, and actually, Dave Brown, one of the owners, hooked me up with my landlord. I'd driven down there. It was the only, when I decided to move to Nashville, I drove there. It was the only place I knew where to go and to use their Wi-Fi and, hang out and chase down my Craigslist ads for apartments and houses and stuff like that. And I had 15 of them. None of them worked out. Dave Brown was setting up the bar, and he's like, "Hey, man, I think my old house is open. Why don't you call my landlord?" And a couple weeks later, we moved in.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah, it's really cool. They're great there, but they're awesome people. I think it's one of the best rooms in Nashville. And we just walked out. We got that showcase at that spot. It was right after the Deep Dark Woods, and there was a huge buzz about them. So we were able to keep some more people in. That's cool things about Nashville, man. I was able to, get really, really good guys that were playing in the band that night. It was just, it was a really great night.
It was a great night. And I'm going to differ with you on that. I don't think it had to do with who came before or after you. The performance itself was stellar. Some people, when it comes to a showcase, I think they're like, five songs, whatever. But sometimes for people like me, that's the only time I'm going to hear a band.
Yeah, that's doing these showcase things. I don't know. I guess I'm perpetually a support act, on a lot of tours, and so I feel really good about. Not to go, "Oh, this is, oh, I'm great at this," or anything like that. I don't mean to be egotistical like that, but I really felt like we really had an on night that night, and it was great. And plus, being able to, because I see that way, like opening slots, even showcase spots, it's the only time that you really get to reach, the people that really sort of, move and shake our little microcosm. Case in point, this interview. It's something it's definitely a skill I try to develop. But, with performance, it's such a shot in the dark, really.
True.
Sometimes, you just, things hit. Sometimes they don't. You just try to be consistent, but I think John Radford was on drums that night, and Joe Manahan on second guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I get to play with Joe, it always raises the bar. he's just such a great musician, and great friend, because my friend Josh Busker from West Virginia is recording at Joe's house right now. So they drove in last night, and I had to get him in the right direction, and just did that, or we'd get together, at the end of go to Dad's practice and play after that until I was about 14 or 15. I remember being into like all this stuff and being after football practice. I was in ninth grade, and I had this Buddy Holly tape, and it was some bonus track or something like that on this little cassette tape that had a live thing of the Surviving Crickets, and they were played Little Richard's Keep a Knockin'. Oh, it was just so awesome. It's like, oh, it's so cool, man, so I played it for a friend of mine at, in the locker room after football practice. He's like, it's like country. Ooh. Put that back away and then just sort of back to my secret rhythm and blues life. So I'm like, okay. I just thought this was just the hippest thing, this rockabilly kind of thing. What's wrong with that?
Right.
So, I was hanging out with my friends and listening to the first couple Metallica albums,
right,
and stuff. And, Poison was huge.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. So that direct was happening. And, it was cool. If you're hanging out, but I remember that was about the same time. I think that right around that time, or sure there, I feel like "And Justice for All" came out. That like changed. Suddenly, you could listen to heavy metal. It was obtainable, which was cool. I was really into that. But I was always just kind of doing my little folky blues thing. And while that was going on, and Dad was taking me to concerts and things like that. Then in Wadsworth, Ohio, I grew up in Massillon, Ohio, mm-hmm. but in Wadsworth, Ohio, there's a high school auditorium there. OJ Work Auditorium, they would have bluegrass shows at. I got to see Bill Monroe when I was about 11 or 12.
Wow.
And I didn't know who he was. his dad had taken me to a couple of them, and you'd see some bands, and some bands were good, and some bands weren't as good. But what I really dug was all these guys that would pay their admission to get into the concerts and never watch it. They'd come in, and they'd go down in the high school cafeteria and pick.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, man, this is crazy. No one's watching. These guys aren't watching the show. And then some of those guys were better than the bands that would, you know, be on. I mean, I didn't understand a lot about, you know, like how that sort of works. And that's just the de-rigger bluegrass.
Yeah.
But I noticed that at the Bill Monroe show, it was way more crowded. And those guys went and watched Bill Monroe. So I was like, okay, this is different. And then, you know, later on, I realized who had seen, you know, the inventor of the music.
I love how you talk about learning to sing the way you sing, because I'm not sure I've had anyone who could be clear about that in that way.
I think anybody can sing. Obviously, it's just, I really do. Some singers are better than others. You know, I mean, it's more what people think is pleasing. I mean, it really is just a muscle. You know, like anything else, you can work it out. It'll perform. Different, you know, people are wired differently. But like my mother, I say a lot about my dad, but my mother's family is a lot of musical people.
Oh.
My mom was born in Liverpool, England.
She
came over to America when she was 20. Her sister had married an American service guy and had moved to Ohio. You know, you're out of school at 15, you know, at that time in England. You know, she lived with her mother going to work, and her mom made her move. She's like, you know, there's no opportunity for you here.
Wow.
Going to America, and she didn't want to go. And, you know, she was just a kid. Just terrifying to think what, you know, going to a different country when you're 20. You know, mom jokes, and she's like, yes, let's still play with golf. I never met her dad. He was gone by the time I was around, but he apparently was a really, really talented mandolin player. And, you know, it's Liverpool, England, and, you know, the post-war, so it's a pretty rough city, you know, especially at that time, you know, it was a shipping port. So he was a docker, the drinking and the fight, and, you know, just part of a lifestyle. And when I've been over to England, you know, people ask me, where are you from? And I said, well, you know, my mom's from Liverpool. And, you know, I said, you know, was your granddad a musician? So I never knew, but I knew he played mandolin. And mom said that he could listen to a song and play it. But, you know, I don't have the ability. So it's in there. So also made my mom a little bit wary.
I'm sure.
Of this as a career choice, but mostly because, you know, she's, you know, worried about her boy, you know, drinking and whatever.
So how did you then get from gigging in coffee shops in Kent, Ohio to ultimately what led you to Nashville? But there's some time in between.
Oh, a little bit, yeah. Well, I just, by the time I graduated from college, I was working 5 nights a week. I had 5 gigs a week. Yeah, so it was killer, you know. I mean, I was working a regular job. You know, I was only going to school a couple days a week at that point. You know, it took me like 6 years to get a bachelor's degree. It was terrible. Really, and I'm not really joking. I mean, it was definitely 5 and a half. Poor parents. I was just mad for it. And it was, and so I always had a gig, and it was a great time. You know, and that would have been our, you know, early to mid 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the economy was great. You know, mm-hmm. The post Stevie Ray Vaughan thing had really opened up. You know, everyone with a little extra dough that liked music opened up a blues bar. It was great. For me, is again, because, you know, they're like, oh man, I can, you know, it was, you know, I can't get a band in here for $150, but I can give this guy $100.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm rich.
$25 so increase.
And play a long time, you know, and I always just learned to, you know, play long sets, and then started to play some rhythm guitar with a local blues band. And I poached some of the guys out of that playing in my band, and we'd had a little trio. But I was probably 20. That's a little hit. I was well into my mid-20s before mm-hmm. I put a band together, probably 26 or so. But I would also do that. You know, I would also sup with this band, and I'd play some Muddy Water stuff. So that's it. Just always working, you know. And there was plenty of gigs to be had, and, you know, they weren't glamorous or anything like that. It
wasn't right.
Like, may have been a little detriment to, you know, me career-wise, because I'm thinking, well, I can go, instead of me saving up money, go and play in some rock club and playing 40 minutes and doing that, you know, I would just go to some bar and play from 10 to 2, but I'd have money in pocket. You know, I liked it. It's my favorite thing to do, so I didn't really think about it that way.
Right.
Didn't have any sort of exposure to that. Probably long term wasn't a great,
right.
wasn't a great choice. It's only now that I realized what, but it really taught me to, and something I really cherish. also to sort of entertain an audience. You're not just a musician. You know, you want people to pay attention to you. You've got to give them, you can't give them a lot of options to not listen to you.
You do that very well live.
That's my shtick.
Hey, it works.
You know, I try to make sure that there's always something going on. Make it look like you're having a good time, because usually I am. You know, once you get, you know, get guitar in your hands, in front of the amps, you know, as long as anything's working mildly well, it's a pretty good time. Playing guitar is really, really fun. I own millions of them. It really is. You should try it.
I hear you about the ability to entertain a crowd, particularly if you're doing all-night sets in bars where people can be watching the football game while they're...
It was a great school.
But then what led you to the point of saying, all right, this career move involves a physical move?
Well, also very late. Actually, I was just getting out of college. I actually had a gig playing the Kent State Folk Festival. You know, instead of just hanging out at it or volunteering at it, you know, I got one of the sets, and it was cool. And that following week, after that, I moved to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, a remote little place in northwest Arkansas. Beautiful place. There's a friend of a friend, his father had a house there, and he was the guy, you know, his family guy, driving back and forth once a month, you know, a 16-hour drive, take care of this house and check on things. And it was sort of, he said, man, I really need somebody to kind of, once the house sit, you know, you can't really pay rent. And I said, but, you know, it's free rent. And my guitar teacher at the time said, hey, you want to watch George's dad? You want a house sit for George's dad's house? And I said, free rent. I said, all right, yeah, awesome. Where is it? In Arkansas. Is there a college nearby? About an hour. All right. I was working all the time. You know, we're just doing gigs and just bar gigs. And I thought, well, you know, in this time of my life, I guess you go on a little adventure. So, you know, I worked all summer. You know, I was gigging a lot. I saved up some money to sort of float me for a while. And, you know, I had free rent. So I packed up all my moved to Eureka Springs, Arkansas. It just happened when I arrived in town, their folk festival was going on, and they had a guy named Jason Eklund, and I think just broken up with a girlfriend or something like that, and was about to leave town. I went to a couple open mic nights that week and met some people. I didn't really know anybody, and I was living about 10 miles outside of town, sort of out in the country. So I'd drive in, I'd hang out all day, and then drive out just for something to do. And it's this beautiful little Victorian kind of a resort town, you know, restaurants and hotels. Lots of artists and stuff like that live there. And just a beautiful place. And Eureka Springs figures in a lot to the story. It's actually where I met my wife.
Oh, cool.
She's from there. And when we met, started dating, her mom was the mayor.
Oh, my gosh.
But that is 15, 16 years down the road. When I was living there, she was in high school and we didn't know each other. And I would like to state that for the record. This is Patrick Sweeney on Country Fried Rock. So that happened. So I'm house sitting this place until it sells. All of a sudden, I'm on this national tour, you know, playing little blues bars. This is the coolest, man. I get a call that the house sold.
Oh, boy.
I'm a week out, and I'm going to be out for 3 more weeks. Like, what do I do?
Right.
You know, I had one friend that was sort of checking on the place, and I told the guys, you know, I was house sitting for them. Hey, this has happened. I've got to do this. They said, oh, that's fine. So we might have a buyer. Okay, well, cool. Well, it sold. I was staying in a little apartment that's this big house, and I was sort of a little apartment in an outbuilding near with this guy where the owner's library was.
Wow.
And owned the house was a writer for the Chicago Tribune. Yeah, it was really, really neat place out in the country. So they said, okay, well, we'll work on the deal, but we'll give you another, you know, 6 weeks or something like that so you can get home and you'll have a week to get settled and find a place. I'm like, well, that's cool. You know, if I had been living in the actual house, I'd have been, someone would just have to come and box up my So Jimmy's wife found me an apartment. She said, it's really cheap. It's $225 a month, utilities included, right behind the stage at Chelsea's, which is where I hung out anyway.
Right.
We played all the time. So I'm like, well, yeah, I know that apartment. Cool. So I moved in there and got off the road, and I paid my rent for 6 months, utilities included. And then Jimmy's foot hadn't healed right, so the next day I had to do another tour with them, which was another 4 weeks.
Wow.
So, and that was, you know, it kept me gone the entire winter. What I didn't realize is Eureka Springs is a resort town, a tourist town. So in the wintertime, nothing's going on. The following year, when I'm not on the road, I'm broke. So I had, eventually just couldn't afford
Right, the famous three-song tape for a bar, that sort of thing.
Yeah, right. So I just, hung out there for a couple of weeks. And my friends, I'm like, man, I think I'm going to hit it. And they're like, well, man, just plenty of jobs. And I said, yeah, man, I don't really want a job. I want to play music. I'm going to go back to Ohio and put a band together and make a record. Because I'd been writing some stuff, and a friend of mine, I actually recorded. Basically, my first record, I want to tell you, I recorded versions of those songs about a year prior.
So
that would have been 97. So I had been writing songs at that point, and that apartment behind Chelsea was really instrumental in that because, I'd be there late hanging out, and there was no getting to bed before closing time.
Right, forget it.
It's right there. And I had a lot of friends sort of my age that would come over. It was just a hangout spot, my little rat hole apartment. But I could load my gear through the window, my front room window.
That's awesome. And
I could also order drinks by phone. So if I didn't want to go all the way down, I'm in my robe and slippers, end up a Bloody Mary through the window, So that was kind of cool, but it's a two-edged sword. That means even when you want some privacy, everyone's knocking on you.
Forget
like,
it.
Hey, man, what are you doing? You hanging out? But I mean, it also just gave me so, living in that town and living in that apartment, without a lot of financial squeeze on me. So all the gigs were Thursday, Friday, Saturday, maybe sometimes Sunday. They're just $50 here, $50 there.
Mm-hmm.
But I could stack a bunch of those up in a weekend. I had all the money I needed.
Right.
I wasn't getting rich, but I was 23 years old.
Right. What's the difference?
What did I need? I didn't care. And so that left me a lot of time. I just, every day I would just practice and practice and practice. There was just nothing else to do, for any girls. I wanted to date, It's like at that, at least at that time, and I wasn't, I was a young man. I wasn't really into having a steady girlfriend or anything like that, So I'm just chilling out, playing guitar, doing some gigs. Early 20s, wasteoid, basically. But I was gigging, and then I realized, you can travel and you can make money and do this. But you can't do that without a CD. I went back home. I was broke, pretty down. It was, moved back to Ohio in the middle of February. And I just sort of felt like, I wasn't going to come home to Ohio without really doing something. And I was pretty disappointed that, we sort of ride that touring and playing clubs kind of thing. I thought that just would, that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't. So I went back home and was on Waystill Brothers' floor while he was in college for a little bit. And then he got me a job at the bike shop that he was working at. So I had me a little job. And then I was gigging, all the time. So I really got into mountain bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Great. But just back to it, gigging. Was doing high bars, doing all that. Put a little band together. Had a regular Monday night. In Ohio, it was the only thing to do in town, so I was really able to build a following and really refine the band, to really do this. So I did that for about a year.
Cool.
Yeah, it was fun a little bit, and lots of Hound Dog Taylor and Elmore James, and more of the Chicago style of blues. Pretty high energy, so I started, doing little dives out into the crowd and like that. Just, all the tricks, working that out as a young, wound-up guy, playing the blues. About that time, Dan Auerbach's dad started to come see us. And then Dan, when he, I don't know if he was quite 20 going yet, he starts really doing. A friend of mine, a guy named Mike Lenz, was giving him some guitar lessons and playing a little bit of music with him.
Cool.
And he said, man, you got here. I'm like, oh, yeah, man. And he knew all this old Hound Dog Taylor stuff and Fred McDonald, all this weird Mississippi stuff that I liked. So I was like, man, you want to be in the band? So we got rid of the bass player and we did two guitars and drums. And for a couple of years, and then Dan had his little band, the Barn Burners, and that was his, his main gig and working with me. And then I'd have some subs to cover for Dan, and we did that. I did that for a couple of years, and then started listening to the first mixes of the first Black Keys record, Dan's band, outside of a little bar in Dover, New Philly, Ohio, somewhere near there. And it was like, whoa, that's cool. And then then a year later, he was on his way. So
crazy.
It was cool. I was just gigging, and playing, and then writing more tunes. I put out my first record that I recorded. It was a solo acoustic record, and I recorded it at the very first pressing of it. I did a little live recording on my Monday night gig of the band playing and played like an Elmore James tune and stuff like Philly up somewhere. I understand, you had to, you got to pay those guys for the concept of that. So, aren't too upset, I guess, but subsequent pressings of it do not include those, and it really works better as an album. That's it. I just sort of kept, you know, I'd travel a little bit, you know, as much as I had this festival in Arkansas, the Blues Festival. I had a nice thing, so I kept going back there every year, play their Blues Festival. I was booking the way to it, and on the way back, I'd expand out of there, and then, you know, we start doing a club gig here and a club gig there. It's just me. I mean, I didn't really know how that worked. So it's another record that had more band stuff on it a couple of years later and some solo stuff. And it went out and started to get some reviews and things like that and travel a little bit more. And then it came time to do another record. I sort of recorded. We had some taper friends that would record some stuff.
And yeah.
I'd burn off a couple copies of some live shows, something like that, sell for $5 just to kind of keep gas in the tank, you know. And then when it came time to do another record, I'd known about this guy, Jimbo Mathis. He had his studio popping down in Arkansas. I was playing the King Biscuit Festival when it was still Biscuit, or did a set, and the sound guy was like, hey, man, I work at the studio, you gotta check it out. And I'd been hearing about it. You know, I made a record, I'm just like, man, it doesn't really sound the way I want it. It doesn't sound as gritty as those old things, but I didn't know why. So I started checking it out, like, oh man, old ribbon mics, old tube pretties, and getting the recordings out of it. So, you know, I saved up some money. We had it was around just after Christmas, New Year's Eve, maybe 405. We recorded, we booked a little run of shows in Memphis and then recorded in Clarksdale. And then I did one day did the record in one day and then drove to our New Year's Eve gig in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Holy moly.
Then I found playing some shows and doing some things. Met this guy named Josh Lederman, a band called Los Diablos from Boston. And their drummer had just sort of formed their own little label called 9 Mile Records.
Yeah.
And he was starting to get going. And I was sending my stuff out to labels and stuff. And, you know, and I was, you know, I just sort of pigeonholed into kind of the blues label. And I wasn't getting much positive feedback. They're like, well, you know, we like this song, but you know, everything's kind of different. Because I've got a lot of different influences and I like doing lots of different stuff. I got kind of a short attention span. And, you know, those guys seemed like they were more into just some guy, you know, just sort of more generic kind of blues, you know, just, you know, some guy singing over 12 bar blues, which I, you know, I love the real thing, but most of the modern stuff is just complete and utter shit. You know, a song isn't a vehicle for a guitar solo. So I just wasn't having any luck. But Rick was like, hey, man, you should send me some stuff, you know, maybe. And I talked to Josh. He's like, yeah, it's a cool label, man. You know, you should check it out. It works hard. So we put our first, put Come On, Come Here out on 9 Mile Records. That really, really, really helped. You know, Rick was able to get some press for us. And then I started touring some more, and I'm actually kind of, I'm legit. You know, this third record, now I'm legit. So touring a little more, got a booking agent. So we're able to tour a little farther. Next record came out that Dan and Arbach produced and engineered. Just by that association, they really started to blow up then, about the time that, maybe just after their Rubber Factory album, or right around that time, maybe Thick Freak. But either way, right around that time period, they really started to blow up, and that really generated a lot of interest. You know, we had a booking. We were starting to get some festivals and things like that. Hey, this is Patrick Sweeney. If you want to hear more of me or find out where I'm going to be, check out www.patricksweeney.com. That's PatrickSweeney. Everyone moved here 10 years before I did. You know, I'm a guy in my mid-30s moving here while all the kids are up and coming and really making it are moving here when they're 20. So that was really, really intimidating. You know, I couldn't get gigs, man. You know, there's no money in the meantime. And it was a little tougher to get quality guy. Like the first tour I did out there, you had some guys who were okay, you know. But it took a while, for people to trust you. All right, this guy's legit. Oh, I like playing this music, and you get to know people. A guy who was instrumental in that was Joe McMahon, a guy who engineered and produced my last record. He was also probably my best friend here in town. And we also have a little band together called the Tiger Beats, which is my little alter ego, and it's all Jimmy Reed, Howlin' Wolf, Bobby Bland. Nothing that wasn't on a 45. Like, we cut it off. Like, the most modern thing we'll play in that band is Tramp. That's it. That's really fun. Joe is a fantastic guitar player, and he's a great engineer, great producer. He was the first guy. I played a set at the Solo's opening set at the Family Wash here, and he was really the first musician guy that, like, was like, hey, man, that was really cool, man. Let's go get lunch. You ever been to Bailey and Cato's, which is a little soul food joint down the street from his house? I'm like, no, I love soul food. You know, him. Now we hang out about every day. And he was instrumental in really getting to know, through him, great musicians. And that's the reason I moved here, was to have, you know, a nice thing too. I don't have to keep a band alive, their full-time job, like, because there's guys who can do the job here. It really is. They're the best musicians in the world here in Nashville. Guys who show up and know the stuff. You give them a CD and they learn it, you know, and they play. And rehearsal is just stops and starts and getting the show straightened out. From taking a few jobs as a side guy, you know, back in the day, you know how tough that is. Be a side guy. It's a special skill. I really try to be as generous as possible, as understanding, and making sure that they want to do the gig. That's been a great, great help to be able to, like, hey, you know, these guys, I want you guys to enjoy yourself first and foremost. You know, we're going to entertain these people. You know, we can get them and play songs. And that's fine. But what I want to do is this. You know, I really want to sell the stuff. So, and they get it. So I've been real lucky, man. There's just lots of good guys. And I think I'm doing a little. There's not a lot of people doing what I'm doing here in Nashville. So it seems a bit my little sort of, I've sort of made my little niche of what I do. You know, my two-trick pony show here, you know.
So creatively, then, where are you headed now?
Right now, not a whole lot. It's looking to be a business, getting gearing up for South by Southwest, a bunch of run shows. Got a new booking agent, Hello Booking. We're great, Matthew. He's a great guy. Like that. Got some dates with going out April with Tim Easton, do some co-bills together. So that's cool. So I've got a gig with at the Five Spot, which is two blocks from my house. Tim Easton is actually on that bill, so I can get to meet him. It's another guy hanging out at the Five Spot, you know, musician hangout here on the East Side. Derek, you know, give me a $2 Tuesday gig. He does this awesome gig.
Yeah.
$2. $2 is the cover. He gets like five or six acts. Everybody plays like five songs. Really great hang. Super nice guy. So, yeah, so guys like that, you know, Nashville's just full of awesome dudes. Like, you know, if there's something different and real and, you know, you're not wearing whatever those weird jeans with the embroidery on, you know, you can really, yeah, thank God those are there, because now you can avoid it. We really love Nashville.
That's
cool.
Like I
said, it was tough for a year and a half. You know, since then, we've, you know, got a lot of friends here. And it seems like everybody from Ohio is moving here anyway. So, you know, I said, what, Dan and Patrick from the Keys moved down just the other night. I ran into a friend of mine from Akron at the little cocktail bar at the top of the street. My buddy Austin, he just moved here and lives down the street. We figured out when we moved here that a friend of my wife's from high school lives down the street. And my friend I ran into lives across the street from them. It's really strange. Synchronicity.
It quickly becomes a really small town.
It really is. You know, if you stay off the highway, you can be anywhere in Nashville in 15 minutes. Kevin Gordon is a songwriter. Like Keith Richards has cut one of his songs. So
Lee Holy Bonham. Moly.
He's sort of part of like the extended crew. My buddy Joe. Joe's been playing with him, Magnahan, that is, playing with Kevin for 15, 20 years. Kevin just released an album called Glory Land. Is absolutely unbelievable. He's a great guy. Really, really literate guy. Definitely right up your parking lot. When you check him out, you see all this thing. You know, he does some really great work. He grew up in rural Louisiana, but also, you know, masters in creative writing. I think he's one of the best. Like,
thank you.
And his new record is AFN amazing.
That is fabulous. Thank you so much for that heads up.
No problem. He is awesome.
Fantastic. Patrick, I really appreciate your time. Cool. Have a great day. Thanks a ton.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Alrighty, bye-bye. Next week on Country Fried Rock, we're chatting with South Carolina native Angela Easterling, whose recent record Beguiler burned up the Americana charts and has recently released an entire album in French. Find out why on Country Fried Rock. Country Fried Rock. Our theme music is from The Full Tones. Our Country Fried Rock stinger is from Steve Soto and the Twisted Hearts. Country Fried Rock. Copyright 2012 by Lilypad Productions. All rights reserved.
Ever he been helping us from Country Fried Rock.
Hey, y'all, it's Sloane Spencer. Thanks so much for finding all these new old episodes of Country Fried Rock. I've got something completely different available these days called Sleep with Rockstars. And it all started from a listener comment back in the very early days of Country Fried Rock who said, you know, I slow these down to 75% and fall asleep to them. And I was like, well, over the years, I started thinking about it, and I recently started Sleep with Rockstars. It's the Gen X Sleep Podcast, and you can find it at sleepwithrockstars.com or your favorite podcast app.